Good evening, and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Wednesday, October 12, 2017. A resident at a UN POC site in Juba says women were abducted by men in uniform just outside the camp on Sunday, and only one has returned.
Especially the female who used to move out to collect firewood, as long as there's no unwilling organizations to provide charcoal. That means if the women move away from here to collect firewood in the forest, the problem will happen.
And South Sudan tops a new list of the worst places in the world for girls' education.
South Sudan came out as number one, Central African Republic, Niger, Afghanistan.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Community leaders at a UN Protection of Civilians site in Juba say a 15-year-old girl and two women who went out to collect firewood are still missing 3 days after being abducted by men in military uniform. One woman who escaped during the ordeal says the three women were kidnapped in broad daylight about 3 kilometers from the UN camp. Tito Justin reports for VOA from Juba.
The UN mission in South Sudan, or UNMISS, says the missing females returned to the UN Protection of Civilian site on Tuesday, but a community leader says that is not true. Juba community leaders at the POC site say 3 of 16 women who went to collect firewood 3 kilometers outside the site on Sunday were rounded up by 20 men in uniform. They say armed men took 3 women and a 15-year-old girl and freed one of the abducted women on Monday. Bom Kubong Gatop, who lives at the POC site, says the security of IDPs outside the UN camp is always a problem.
Especially the female who used to move out to collect firewood, as long as there's no unwilling organizations to provide charcoal. That means if the women move away from here to collect firewood in the forest, the problem will happen, as it happened now.
An eyewitness at the POC site says the woman who was released by armed men fell sick and received a treatment at International Medical Corps Clinic within the POC. The whereabouts of the other 2 women and the girl is still unknown. The woman who escaped during the attack says she was able to run away when the gunman appeared. For private concerns and her security, we will only refer to her by her first name, Martha. Speaking native Nueri language, Martha says IDPs have no source of affordable energy for cooking in the camp, so women must venture outside the perimeters of the camp to collect firewood.
When we went to look for firewood and charcoal, many people came. They have guns and are in military uniforms. When some of us saw them, we ran. That's why you can see us here. What happened last time was really something deadly.
A bag of charcoal sells for 4,000 South Sudanese pounds at the UN Protection of Civilians site in Juba. At that price, many IDPs say they cannot afford to buy charcoal for cooking meals. Women in the camp often gather in groups of 10 to 20 each afternoon to look for firewood. The latest attack has created panic in the camp. Martha says aid agencies should provide free charcoal for IDPs at the POC site.
I am telling those helping us that our problem here of charcoal and firewood should be resolved. They can help us transport them within the camps because outside the fence of POC is not safe. Those who are helping us and the aid agencies should know that we want help to solve our problems.
Earlier this year, UNMISS said it improved security around the camp, especially in Jebel where the abduction took place. Kubong says women and children are constantly at risk. He says the latest incident affects all IDPs who depend on firewood as a source of energy.
What can we do if the female are not moving to the forest? There will be no, they will not cook for the kids. And if they go to the forest, they will have those problems. It's very terrible. And it seemed to be very intentional. We don't even know what motivated those soldiers to do such atrocities, such big problems. Kidnapping them. This is terrorizing the community.
Char Jemis is a community leader at the UN Protection of Civilians Site 3 in Juba. Jemis is calling on the government and the UN to apprehend the men who kidnap women outside the POCs.
We don't know really when this thing is going to end. Although we have a war in our country, we have to know really our women that are part of our community. We cannot do something bad to them. That work is not good.
In an email response, UNMISS spokesman Daniel Dixon says UNMISS has not received any confirmed reports of an abduction and or rape of three women and a girl outside the protection of civilian site on Sunday. Dixon says he was told by community leaders that four women who were missing on Sunday returned yesterday. But community leader Char James told VOA Today that the two women and the girl are still missing.
I told you yesterday in the statement you took from me, we don't have any information about those two ladies and one young girl, 15 years old. We don't have any information about them.
Jamie says IDPs are working with the host communities to locate the missing women. Nearly 38,500 South Sudanese are sheltering at UNMISS Protection of Civilian Sites in Juba. Many of them fled their homes in 2013 when deadly fighting erupted in Juba between the South Sudan Army and supporters of former First Vice President Riek Machar. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
Traders in Jonglei State Capital Bor are asking state authorities to protect their stock at night. The traders say they have lost a huge amount of their inventory to armed robbers who broke out into seven shops 3 weeks ago. State authorities admit night robberies are rampant in the area, but insist that police are investigating all of the incidents. Dengai Deng has this report for VOA from Bor.
Maror market trader Achek Thon sells mobile phones and SIM cards in his shop. Thon says armed robbers broke into his shop in the middle of the night 2 weeks ago and stole about 130 mobile phones.
We were having 40 phones, that is 50 days techno. One goes for 5,000. The 90 were small techno, 32 days, which goes for 3,000 pounds. So when we add that, our amount, it reached up to almost 485K. That was the stroke we have. And imagine just waking up in the morning and find maybe that the thing you are working for and you just find it is gone. You can imagine that. That's a big loss.
Another trader, Yusuf Mohammed, is a Kenyan national who has been doing business in South Sudan for 9 years. Mohammed owns a food grocery in Bor. He's speaking in Kiswahili. Mohammed says last week robbers stole merchandise worth 70,000 South Sudanese pounds from his shop.
My four cartons of oil have been stolen, 5 bags of beans, 2 cartons of milk, and 20 cartons of azam flour. Have lost a lot, and you know there were no thieves. I don't know where they are coming from. They have become very many.
Solomon Makweir sells mattresses and chairs at his store at Bor's Maror Market. He says he too lost stock worth more than 84,000 pounds after burglars robbed his shop 2 days ago.
I've lost 6 big mattresses, 7 chairs, and 12 pairs of shoes. I do not know what happened, why the rate of theft has increased like this. 3 other shops were also looted the same night my shop was broken into. We pay 100 SSP each month for security, and I don't know exactly what happened to the police.
Makweir says officials should beef up nighttime police patrols. Abraham Cholukech, Secretary General of Bor's Chamber of Commerce, says his office has recorded dozens of cases of robberies at 7 shops 3 weeks ago.
Sometimes these thefts are actually, the police apprehend them. After some time, you see them walking around in the town. So, you know, it's very concerned. How do they get out, you know, when they are in the prison?
Kedge is asking the police to do much more to fight crime in Bor town. Major Daniel Mabure, the officer in charge of police patrols in Bor town, admits the rates of night robberies is way up, but says the police have apprehended 7 suspects so far.
You know, the market is big. When they are seeing those of security, they are going at this side, then they will come at this side. Yeah, it was there before, but now increasing, it's now become difficult.
Mabir says a lack of security lights along the streets of our town prevents police from catching criminals at night. For VOA News, I am Dengaiding in Bor.
Nine of the worst countries for girls trying to get an education are in Africa. In a new study, the One Campaign Anti-Poverty Group says South Sudan tops the list of the 10 worst countries. Afghanistan is the only non-African nation on the list. Education activists say getting girls in school has lifelong benefits for girls and their communities. Alice Jowett, education policy manager for the One Campaign, tells VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson that having girls in school reduces child pregnancy rates, improves the health of mothers and babies, and helps lift economic growth.
The report really talks about how girls are missing out of school at a higher level than boys in 10 countries in particular. South Sudan came out as number one, Central African Republic, Niger, Afghanistan, Chad, Mali, Guinea, Burkina Faso, Liberia, and Ethiopia. And what you'll learn from that is that 9 out of 10 of those countries are in Africa, and they are all fragile states. So we're really wanting to kind of shed light on the importance of recognizing that these are the toughest places for a girl to get an education.
Now, is the problem getting worse, or are you seeing in your study improvements, maybe not in these 10 countries, but in some of the others?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, since 2000, the number of girls missing out on school globally fell steadily, and then it stalled in recent years. And actually, the latest data in 2015 marked the first time it started moving in reverse. So we're actually seeing a rise in the number of girls out of school now globally. So that's obviously really concerning for us. So what we really want to do is have 2018 be the year of turning this around. So it starts with the Global Partnership for Education replenishment in the early next year, which we're hoping will have a really big impact on the number of girls that are missing out in school.
What has caused the reversal?
That's something that it's hard to know. It's going to be really interesting as well to see the 2016 data when that comes out and find out what's happening there. We definitely need to see more investment in education. That's definitely tailored off. So we need more global and domestic investments in education. I think that will really make a strong difference as long as it's coupled with reforms.
Well, what are some of the other things that the international community as well as local communities can be doing to get children, particularly girls, into the classroom?
We've actually got a set of policy recommendations on this, which we call Make Education Work for Every Girl. So there are four key areas for this. Breaking every barrier to girls' education, so having national governments assess the barriers that are actually keeping the girls out of school and then learning once they're in school. Investing in every teacher, so bolstering teacher training and support, monitoring outcomes and data. I mean, one of the big findings of this report are big data gaps in education data, and we really, really need to invest more in data and disaggregated data. And then connect every classroom, so the use of technology, internet, and ways of reaching marginalized communities that are outside of traditional classrooms as well as within classrooms.
That's Alice Jowett, the education policy manager for the One Campaign, speaking with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson in Washington. You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America. The Kiir administration assures oil investors they'll be safe if they come to South Sudan. Find out more when we return.
South Sudanese in the diaspora have mixed reactions about what is happening in their country. This week, South Sudan in Focus host John Tanza engages the diaspora in a spirited discussion about what South Sudanese should do to bring peace in their country.
Unity is possible when we stop the hate.
What are we not doing to bring peace to our country?
The voices of the diaspora on ending the conflict in South Sudan. This week on South Sudan in Focus.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today.
What's the worst weather event that you've lived through?
Summer in South Sudan, because I get to have rashes on my neck and everywhere. And that just makes my look looks bad.
That was back in Khartoum in 1997. There was a time we went to the market to buy some food items and so many things. But then came a very terrible weather. That is a sandstorm. That was one of the worst weather conditions I have seen in my life.
That was last year's rainy season when Malawi experienced the floods and some of the houses had to be washed away.
I was very young and I went outside to get something thunderstruck. I don't know how it happened, but I found myself on the floor. I couldn't walk.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. Some South Sudanese in the diaspora say it is time a new leadership is groomed for South Sudan. Community leaders and activists in the United States say South Sudan has a problem because the country's leaders have not completed their goals. Those in the diaspora talk about the role of leadership in the ongoing crisis in the country with my colleague John Tanza.
My name is Atem Malak. I'm interning here at Peace Tech Lab. But there are people that don't like what is happening in the country, and they don't see those two as a solution. Like if I ask any South Sudanese, I don't think they will say the solution will come from both Riek and Kiir. I think they have other options that they think that could happen. So if we could talk with those leaders and talk with community leaders, youth leaders, and say, you know what? We need to start acting out as people because these people have failed to show leadership.
Sure,
can I say something?
I just wanted to
give him, hear the thing.
And I just say, this is radio, start by telling us your name and talk.
Okay, this is Nyamal. Okay, I'm trying to relate my question to Atem. When people say that they're pointing finger between Riek and Kiir, here's the thing. The government themselves are the one that actually doing majority of work that are actually messing up the country. They put Dr. Riek into the confinement, however way you want to say it, in South Africa. You see what I mean? And they pay $400,000 a month.
But let us have facts here. You don't have evidence of that. It is hearsay. It is hearsay.
That's true.
You don't have any proof that South African government is paying that money.
So we can get back to the point of our discussion. My name is Kwaji Lasu. I'm speaking to you this afternoon in my capacity as South Sudanese. I think I would like to commend Reverend James as well as Atem. However, I disagree with a few points that they brought forward. As far as Reverend James, I think you have a very good point from a spiritual point of view. Forgiveness. But we cannot forgive until we know the root cause. What is the problem? What are we forgiving? That's number one. As far as what Atem have said, you know, my background is healthcare. Any part of your body that is ailing you, it must be incised.
Now, I want us to use the common man's language. Incised. Incised.
Right. Surgically has to be removed. That's ailing you, or medically has to be taken care of. Our problem in South Sudan, as I mentioned, is we are very polarized as a society. And I blame it to the senior SPLM from day one. We fought the North as one block, as South Sudan, against oppression of the North. Today, we're oppressing ourselves. The failure of SPLM, and I challenge many of them that I know, I talk to them personally, these SPLM cadre or leadership have failed to instill nationalism and nationhood among our people. That's why today we see people pay allegiance to their community, to their tribes, to their personal friends. Going back to my point.
But again, someone is going to ask, what are you doing to instill nationalism in yourself, Eskwaje?
I do believe in nationalism.
But what are you doing to, you know, pass that on to someone?
Well, through my leadership that I've been involved for the last few years, I always preach about being as a model citizen of South Sudan, love the way you want to be loved and see people not because of their tribes, but because they come from, rather because of South Sudan. This has to happen. My drastic or radical approach to address the case in South Sudan, I will respectfully ask Dr. Riek, Salva, since the two of them cannot work in tandem, they need to step aside. Leave the country for the new breed of leaders, leaders that can prepare a nation for democratic way of governance.
Nathaniel, you are keeping quiet. Silence endorse or reject? Are you in agreement with these people?
Well, definitely I'm Nathaniel. I live here in D.C. I think a lot of damage has been done to our country. And we as individuals from South Sudan really feel sorry because we put a lot of energy and effort into creating South Sudan, whether we are in the diaspora or at home. So now The foundation of our country is in our hands. What do we need to do? For me, I look at it as my responsibility. And I think every South Sudanese should look at it that way. Now, we cannot blame the international community or the region because we invited them. For example, a simple analogy would be if I'm married and I beat my wife every day.
You shouldn't be doing that here because you'll be arrested.
And I am beating my wife every day. That means I am inviting my neighbors to intervene.
That's a classic South Sudanese example.
Yes.
I know, but
yes. So now when we are killing ourselves, we are inviting the region, we are inviting the international community to come in. They are here to help us. The question is, are we willing to accept the help? If we are, then we have to implement what they say by simply implementing the agreement. The current agreement is not being implemented. Let us write a permanent constitution. Let us reform all the sectors that are...
Nathaniel, sorry to interrupt you. They say it is easily said than done.
The
problem is how. What are you doing to ensure that there is a permanent constitution written? There is preparation for election. You, as Nathaniel Nyong, this is the question. We are bringing
it
to you.
As an individual, I relate to my friends. I relate to my South Sudanese. I talk to them about why we need to believe in that unity of purpose.
Atem, you have been listening to him. He has made several points, but his points are all targeted towards the leadership in the country. But someone will say, what are you doing to help President Kiir implement the things that he wants to do? Because you have a role.
Myself?
Yes.
Okay.
As a South Sudanese, because these are some of the issues that bring an end to the conflict.
What I'm doing is like what happened today. You count the number of 7,000 Sudanese. If we add more and we have some other South Sudanese coming together and talk about South Sudan issues somewhere, that will send a message to our leadership and to some other people who want to keep going with the issue that we have. So I am saying that I and brothers and some other people that are South Sudanese and people who are helping South Sudanese, anywhere you are talking about this, you have to begin. I begin myself that I need peace. So I don't have no issue with nobody now. I'm expecting every South Sudanese that way. That's my job. And if we took that responsibility as a South Sudanese, that will eliminate what is going on now. Whoever blaming the president, I don't blame him because the president is the president. So any other issue under him is his responsibility.
Some South Sudanese in the diaspora talking about leadership in South Sudan. Tomorrow, my colleague John Tanza discusses with the diaspora the importance of diversity trust building among South Sudanese. Kenya's opposition held rallies in Nairobi and Kisumu today as the country awaits word from the Electoral Commission on whether the rerun of the presidential election will go forward as planned. Opposition leader Raila Odinga's withdrawal from the race yesterday has pushed Kenya further into uncharted territory. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
Thousands of protesters took to the streets in Nairobi Wednesday, following Tuesday's announcement by opposition leader Raila Odinga that he will not participate in the rerun of the election, set for October 26th. Odinga and his NASA opposition coalition argue that according to a 2013 Supreme Court ruling, their withdrawal means that the Electoral Commission, or IEBC, must cancel the polls and conduct fresh nominations, which should take place at least 90 days before a general election. Protester Jonathan Ogasso says he agrees with Odinga.
I think he has exercised his democratic right, which is enshrined in the Constitution of Kenya, and that, in essence, nullifies the election that was scheduled for 26th of October. So we are going back to a new election after 90 days. That's all we know.
But he may not know. The IEBC could decide to hold elections in 2 weeks as scheduled. The commission could also decide that President Uhuru Kenyatta is the winner by default. That option became more complicated Wednesday after the High Court ruled that Third Way Alliance leader Ekuru Aukot could run in the October 26 election since he took part in the petition that nullified the previous one. Or the IEBC could agree with NASA's interpretation and instruct the parties to hold fresh nominations. Nairobi-based political writer and commentator Barack Maluka believes this option to be the most ideal path, saying that the Supreme Court's 2013 guidance should be followed.
And that way, we can be sure that within a period of just about 90 days, the country could put this thing behind it. Any other avenue, I see a lot of litigation, and I see a lot of delay and heightening of tempers, and I see a lot of confusion on any other avenue.
Schaefer Okore is a program officer at political engagement organization Siasa Place. She agrees that the IEBC should conduct elections after fresh nominations, after they fix the problems addressed by the Supreme Court. And she urges calm.
The Kenyan voters right now, we need to all come down and start learning from the fact that our democracy is being pushed to grow and not being pushed for doom. I don't understand why people are so pessimistic about what happened. I mean, a presidential candidate withdrawing is not the end. A presidential candidate withdrawing should all wake us up to realize that there are loopholes still in our constitution, and these loopholes need to be addressed.
Kenya has been in electoral limbo since the original results were nullified on September 1st, due to what the Supreme Court called irregularities and illegalities in the transmission of results. Now the country waits for the IEBC to say how it plans to proceed, in an electoral season that seems to grow more dramatic with each passing day. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
And that's our show for this Wednesday. We leave you with the song Kanda Yanini by Papi Tex.
Jean-Paul Chioyo, mon ami.
We've been listening to Papi Tex with the song Kanya Yinini. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. We're glad you could be here. Tell us what you think about the show. You can check us out on the web at southsudan@voanews.com or find us on our Facebook site at South Sudan in Focus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Bilongi
bako mikokela bisonkala.